Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, joining you once again for a very creepy and disturbing, yet enlightening, finale to the series covering the Butcher of Plainfield, Ed Gein. As we talked about in previous episodes, Eddie's legendary persona as a ghoulish madman ultimately gave way to a plethora of imitation, first in the form of Robert Bloch's fictional novel Psycho, along with Alfred Hitchcock's film, which reimagined the Odd Bachelor as Norman Bates. Before long, he had inspired creation of the horrifying man-child character Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, as well as many other aspects of that film, from the home full of human remains to grave robbery to the dead dressed in formal wear. And that influence didn't stop there. By the early 1990s, Ed Gein was once again immortalized in the canon of American film when The Silence of the Lambs, a novel by Thomas Harris, was adapted for the big screen and included a detective chasing a serial killer called Buffalo Bill, inspired by Gein, who privately abducted, murdered, and skinned heavier women and enjoyed dressing in women's clothes while pretending to be a woman, though he wasn't actually trans. Buffalo Bill became nothing less than completely infamous and legendary in his own right, having uttered the hilarious but terrifying line to his victim that goes like this: "It puts the lotion on its skin, or it gets the hose again." Buffalo Bill is speaking to a living, breathing woman, yet notice what he's doing that Eddie also did. He's speaking to a person who is a subject, yet addressing her in the context of it, which specifically accommodates what? It allows a change in perception from the victim being subjective, or a person, to being objective, or an object. It's the same as Eddie making furniture out of dead people. Now, when Buffalo Bill utters that line, what's happening is that his prospective victim is trapped at the bottom of a dry well in his basement, which manifests the idea of the unconscious mind. Bill wants to become a woman, but can't, and that's his emotional wound. There is a woman inside of him dying to get out, trapped inside his emotional world with no way to escape. Without a way to change, there's no way to cleanse himself of the need to become a woman, so he manifests the image necessary to tell that story in his basement. Yet what makes it brilliant, just as happened with Ed Gein, is that this place isn't actually his house. It's the home of a dead woman, and he's now inhabiting it in the same way Eddie was inhabiting his dead mother's psyche when she passed away. So Buffalo Bill has the woman he wants to be down in the dry well in the basement, aka in the unconscious mind, waiting to be realized, waiting to rise and overtake him, manifesting the physical reality of his emotional desire. But the universe offers no water in the well for the cleansing, because this isn't an emotional endeavor involving evolution. Therefore, due to that dryness, so to speak, Buffalo Bill is desperately trying to get the prospective victim to put lotion on her skin, and her refusal, symbolic of nature saying, "Bro, you can't undergo this change without an emotional movement first," makes him angry. So as there is no water for the cleansing, and she won't apply the lotion, Buffalo Bill says, "It puts the lotion on its skin, or it gets the hose again." In Psycho, this is the moment Janet Leigh is in her boss's office, and the huge painting behind her head shows a vast desert surrounding her. She knows change is impossible here without movement, and so to manifest that idea, when she stands, she moves away from that painting and in front of one featuring a waterway surrounded by abundant lush growth. Of course, that legendary shower scene in Psycho is no different. Norman Bates wants to watch Janet Leigh or Marion Crane undergo the symbolic shedding of the outer skin or clothes and subsequent cleansing with water, and then he's going to kill her. Once she gives herself the hose, so to speak, inside the shower, Norman Bates comes to kill her. But he comes dressed as his mother, and the point is that it's the woman living inside these disturbed men psychologically, driving them to kill the embodiment of those women outside. It's a love-hate thing. A person hates the abuser for what he has suffered and loves the abuser because the abuse in question left them forever desirous of pleasing that monster. They spent so many years trapped inside that madness that they developed a psychosis in which they didn't know how to do anything but abide the same logic. Yet at the same time, they're hurting and need to tell you the truth. And so, with Buffalo Bill in The Silence of the Lambs, his most explosive moment of anger, even though the situation gets much worse afterward, is when he erupts at the prospective victim, Catherine Martin, for refusing to put the lotion on her skin. Bill can't deal with the well being dry, so to speak, because that well is the unconscious mind where emotional cleansing takes place that lets us shed our old skin and assume a new identity. Instead of shedding his own ego, or outer skin, so to speak, in the form of his current identity to become his authentic self instead, he is literally trying to shed a woman's skin so that he can get inside it. The sociopath shortcuts emotional evolution and technological necessity with crude manipulation because there is no path to cleansing for them. The well is dry down there. But if that happens inside your head and you don't possess the emotional capacity to talk about it, then you're going to tell people in images. So in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when the two young lovers go to the swimming hole at their friend's childhood home, it's gone, completely dried up. There's nothing left. And in their story, what it's saying is that the past is gone. You aren't children any longer. You're in adult bodies. The change is complete. And therefore, going back to the past emotionally while being in this adult body and seeking those past comforts is going to make your life a barren wasteland. So the swimming hole is dry. The desert painting behind Marion Crane is dry. The well in Buffalo Bill's basement is dry. So how do you think Eddie Gein will tell us the same? Well, when the police enter Gein's home the night he becomes a suspect in Bernice Worden's death, even though they find some of the most terrifying and macabre sights you could possibly imagine, the one that seems to baffle them most, because it's completely nonsensical, is that Eddie Gein has filled the sink basin in his kitchen with sand. They're looking at each other like, if you clog a sink basin with sand, it doesn't drain. Why on earth would somebody do that? And there was no answer in practicality other than to say that Ed Gein was insane. Eddie is using a very simple and straightforward symbolic image to tell us what's wrong inside his head in the absence of the capacity to do it emotionally. So the basis for Eddie Gein becoming profoundly legendary, even far in excess of the few characters I've mentioned here today, is not the depths to which he stooped in committing such heinous crimes, but in our ignorance of their meaning. We simply assign these sightings terms like insanity and psychosis, which are relevant and true, but they fall short. People hurt others physically when they're hurting emotionally, and so when considering motive, a person's physical actions and environment speak to the truth because they're a projection of what's occurring inside the head. Creating these images is a perfectly normal part of life. We all do it. For instance, when the seasons change and growth heads toward death, a homeowner with a swimming pool would either cover that pool or drain it so that there is no longer any access to the water inside. Once the seasons change again and death cycles back to a season of growth, the water returns and you submerge or cleanse yourself in it after shedding the outer skin of clothing. So let's get into the spooky details of what's to come here. When we left off in the last episode, Frank Warden had just returned to his mother's store to find Bernice missing, yet there was a pool of blood on the floor in which it seemed a body had been dragged. Those streaks led to a doorway, and outside in the parking lot, it was apparent Bernice's work truck was missing. Frank Warden, like many people back then in small towns, wore many hats, so to speak, and along with assisting at Bernice's store, he was also a sheriff's deputy. Of course, this case is as close to home as it gets, and so he needs to contact the current sheriff, Arch Schley, to assist. From the crime scene evidence, they initially surmised that, just like had happened in the Mary Hogan murder 3 years prior, someone shot Bernice and loaded her into a vehicle before taking off. A witness from the filling station across the street saw a man inside her truck fleeing. Yet, what they would later learn is that this series of events Eddie engaged was actually way more audacious than they had considered initially. They hadn't considered another alternative because there was no sense to be made of what he actually did. Wouldn't the killer just want to shoot her, load the body, and go? Well, what really happened is that Eddie shot Bernice and then left in her truck alone, ditching the vehicle nearby before returning to his Ford, which was parked near the store in town. He then drove the Ford back to the store, and it was only then that he loaded Bernice's body into his vehicle to take it back to the farm. So why on earth did he ditch her work truck? Well, on a practical level, he was probably thinking that if people came back later and saw her missing, along with the truck, they would have no cause for alarm because they'd think she was out on a delivery. Yet, there was blood all over the floor in the store. They weren't going to actually think that at all. Eddie had allegedly tried to clean up the blood to no avail. There was obviously too much. He proceeds with ditching the truck anyway, even though nobody is going to be fooled for a second about where the crime took place. Frank Warden literally realizes his mother has been attacked within seconds of entering the crime scene. So clearly, Eddie is not utilizing reason and logic here, but is instead indulging a psychotic and also symbolic narrative conducive to his irreconcilable emotional desires. Now, what do we know about Eddie in relation to Bernice? He's attracted to her and desires to be with her sexually. Conversely, what do we also know is true in relation to his mother? That directly conflicts with that desire. His mother wouldn't approve. Eddie's stifled emotional life is caught between those ideals. He very much wants to be with Bernice romantically or sexually, yet also wants to please mother's demand to never be with a woman, so he can't. He's stuck. Eddie doesn't possess the emotional capacity to express the irreconcilable pain of that dilemma, and so he's going to use symbolic imagery to cope. He's going to tell the rest of us what he wants here, and also why it fails. The police find Bernice's truck in what is described as a tall grove of pine trees, and this place fulfills a very specific function for Plainfield locals. It's their lover's lane. This is where people in cars and trucks go to participate in sexual activity that, for whatever reason, is not acceptable in their homes and has to be secret. So, by Eddie taking the truck to the lover's lane, what he is saying is that he wanted to get with Bernice sexually by going to a place like this where Mother wouldn't know, because such activity would never be allowed in his mother's house. Yet, when the cops look inside the vehicle, it's empty except for blood on the driver's side of the interior. Basically, Eddie had the desire to go here with Bernice. It's what he wanted. But what he eventually needed to accommodate was Mother. And Mother wouldn't want him to be there getting it on with Bernice. So now, think of Norman Bates, with Mother being the one who perpetrates the violence that prevents his desires from coming to fruition, and instead inserts her desires manifested in physicality, specifically death. Imagine Eddie actually goes to this lover's lane with Bernice, and then ask, if this happened, how would Mother react when she found out? What would Mother do to stop it? Well, first off, it's Bernice's truck, and so Bernice would be behind the wheel, which is where we find blood. Yet, there's no one on the passenger side. So if we ask what Mother would do if she found these two at Lover's Lane, she would kill the evil, so to speak, in the form of Bernice, and then take her son back home to the place where he could get away from sin. Therefore, when the cops look inside the truck, they find blood on the driver's side, symbolizing Bernice's death. Yet the passenger seat indicates nothing more than absence. That person, or lover, is just missing. I mean, if you're at Lover's Lane, the assumption is two people in the truck. Mother would believe that Bernice needed to change, meaning that she needed to shed her outer skin, or ego, to become the authentic self beneath. So at that point, Eddie takes Bernice home and prepares to skin her because it's what Mother would want. This is how Mother punishes Eddie. Instead of allowing him to change emotionally, she makes him change others physically to extract the things that she finds sinful and unacceptable for her precious son Eddie to indulge. And we know Eddie is completely preoccupied by the psychosis endured in such an undertaking as he steals Bernice's cash register and brings it home for the police to find and interpret as this act being about change. The police enter to find an unopened cash register and see that Eddie couldn't get the change he desired, which is what led to killing Bernice. Basically, the cops find this truck at Lover's Lane, and though the symbolic narrative doesn't resonate explicitly on a conscious level, it does indeed still intuitively lead them right to the place where the perpetrator and victim have gone. So on the frigid night of November 16, 1957, Sheriff Art Schley and another cop head out to the creepy, dilapidated Gein farmhouse, which by this time has gone from a state of disrepair to being nearly uninhabitable. It sits on 195 acres of farmland, so outside of the wind, the isolation and silence in this place create a feeling of danger, an ever-growing intuition that something is wrong. The house, shrouded in darkness, absent of electricity, looms in the thick blackness of shadowy tree branches, reaching out in every direction. In this moment, the ghost of Augusta Gein was real. The gentlemen make their way around the premises, realizing they're alone. They seek access points to the house, only to find everything locked. Though it's when they come upon the summer kitchen that they ascertain the door is merely held shut by a flimsy latch. They kick in the door and enter complete darkness. The men turn on their flashlights and survey the room, which is full of junk. Yet something in there is warm, or humid, as though it's causing steam to rise. And there's a smell, a very distinct one. The stench of slaughter. Not something that died last week. Not like a squirrel under your front porch. But something very large that has just died and is on the precipice of decomposition. The sheriff uses his flashlight to begin searching a summer kitchen, while the other man goes to the door leading into the main house and finds it locked. As the sheriff turns, circling his flashlight beam upon heaps of trash, he accidentally bumps into something behind him. Schley quickly turns, because the thing he feels against him is not an object. It's like a person. The sheriff swings around and points his flashlight beam. There, hanging upside down from a wooden crossbar that's perhaps 3 feet wide, is the ghastly pale body of Bernice Worden. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Becoming familiar with yourself is an ongoing, lifelong process, especially because we're always growing and changing. And therapy is all about deepening your self-awareness and comprehension of your identity, because sometimes we don't know what we want or why we're driven to do what we do beyond an intuitive level until we express ourselves by talking through things. With that in mind, BetterHelp connects you with a licensed therapist who can take you on that journey of self-discovery, no matter where you are in life. Therapy, among many other benefits, is helpful for learning positive coping skills or how to set boundaries. It also empowers you to find the best version of yourself. Of course, therapy isn't just utilized to assist those who've experienced major trauma. From professional concerns to domestic issues, we all have problems that might benefit by indulging therapy. If you're thinking of starting therapy or just seeking more information, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's entirely online, allowing it to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Discover your potential with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/CCMM today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CCMM. The crossbar, sharpened at both ends, was inserted through an Achilles tendon on one ankle, and then, as that same method tore the tendon in half on the other side, that ankle had to be tied with cord to provide the necessary support. Her torso had been slit wide open, completely emptied, and then washed clean to a point that there was no longer any blood. They said her insides were actually glistening clean, obviously manifesting the idea of an emotional cleansing by removing all the bad stuff inside you. And of course, part of that cleansing is to change what's going on inside your head emotionally. But because Eddie can't do that, he removes the head to say he's incapable of solving the issue of the disunity between his childlike mind and adult body. In our evolutionary narrative, we ascend, freeing ourselves and shedding embodiment on our way up, or on the path to becoming God, in which the head, or mind, aka God, must separate from embodiment in a cleansing. So here, Eddie cleanses the body and then removes the head to symbolically say that a cleansing has been undergone, in which he disembodied and then, like the Father, the mind, or head, disappeared. Accordingly, he proceeds to hide the head after removing it, manifesting the idea of it disappearing. That's symbolic of what happens during the ascension process. You go up, freeing yourself from the shackles of embodiment or ego and become the authentic self of the white light or God. So Eddie removes the head, cleanses the insides, and then waits for what to happen in the aftermath. He's waiting on these people to come. The sheriff completes Eddie's symbolic act by shining the flashlight on the carcass, leaving a beam in which it looks like the white light, or God, is leaving the body behind in a straight line heading outward from within. Yet in physicality, you don't get freedom or ascension. Instead, you remain stuck and descend. He who does this emotionally evolves to deification, manifesting Christ, but he who does this in physicality alone receives the opposite, which is becoming the Antichrist. It's structural. If you save others by sacrificing yourself, you are a savior, but if you sacrifice others in order to save or preserve yourself, you're the Antichrist. So here, instead of showing us symbolic imagery in which the disembodiment process leads upward to the heavens in ascension, that cleansing of what's inside us and ultimate disembodiment occurs in the opposite direction, going down to hell. Bernice's headless, cleaned-out carcass points down at the floor instead of up at the ceiling, because this is the work of the Antichrist, not Christ. The Savior character is supposed to offer emotional salvation, but when that act is corrupted in physicality, it offers only physical preservation. This story, more than anything else, is a tale warning us about the dangers of extreme conservatism, of not letting go when it's time to change. That conservatism can quickly become the desperation to preserve, and by not changing, what occurs is increasing mental illness leading to violence. The red giant leaves us awash in blood, but also precipitates the necessary emotional cleansing through tragic fate, which means that conservatism often has to get really ugly before the necessary changes or progress can manifest. Right now, if you put something in a pot of water, how would you get it to rise to the surface? It would just sit on the bottom, right? If it had any weight to it, if it had any substance. Well, you have to turn up the heat. You boil it. And when you do, the thing that was buried deep below suddenly rises to the top and threatens to spill over the edge. That is how extreme conservatism is purged in a changing world that requires both conservatism and progress to facilitate evolution. You turn up the heat, meaning expanding the red giant, bringing the ugliness to the surface where it can be purged or cleansed through tragic fate. It's a fascinating construction, and that's why the red giant is necessary. It's purging or cleansing the past. But just like we see in society, and as happened in Ed's mind, we hold on to the past with a death grip because it's the place that brings us comfort inside our heads. As things change, we get closer to death. Our ideology gets closer to death. And so sometimes change can be very daunting because it screams to us that death is on its way. For all of us, when indulging any type of conservatism or unwillingness to change or unwillingness to move forward, we do so in favor of comfort. Inside our heads, we want the comfort of things never changing because they always do. Everything is taken from us. So if Eddie wants to tell us that, where are we going to find Bernice Warden's head? Well, that means we need a place that reverses the symbolic imagery from what we'd see emotionally, or uses the emotional mirror. Now, if shining the flashlight on Bernice's white body created the white light, then we just need to do the same thing here for the head, but again, in a place where the head is not only hidden or has symbolically disappeared, but one that offers a huge amount of physical comfort outside the head to mirror the lack of emotional comfort found within. Therefore, they point the flashlight at two mattresses lying in a corner of the summer kitchen and notice a bulge between them. The flashlight beam on the white mattresses gives us white light, so we know what's under there. They find Bernice Warden's hidden head. And again, the mind is the rising white light of the deity. So when they peel back that top mattress, in the glow of the flashlight, they see steam rising from the head. It was still so freshly cut that placing it between those two mattresses, even in the cold, left heat suppressed and trying to escape. This is when other relevant parties begin to arrive, from cops to crime lab technicians. They enter the home through the inner door leading from the summer kitchen to the main house and find the interior pitch black. As their flashlights comb the darkness, there was an eerie feeling present in the silence that said they were more than apprehensive about this endeavor to inhabit a place that was allegedly haunted. A place that had not been visited by anyone for years because Eddie's secrets became more and more vulnerable to the scrutiny of outsiders. It was a terrifying place, one of legend, one that many of them drove by all the time, but never dared to enter. And here they were. Yet, even though the local children had been right in their assertion that this was a haunted house, one protected by the ghost of Augusta Gein, the greater truth is that the atrocities they were about to witness inside this home would permanently change the American landscape. From Norman Bates to Leatherface to Buffalo Bill, the horrors Eddie Gein's Oedipus complex revealed to the world spawned a genre. Sure, horror existed before Ed Gein, and will long after he's gone. But on this night, everything changed. In the same way Charles Manson shattered the free-loving innocence of the late 1960s hippie era, Ed Gein cast a dark cloud over Midwestern decency in which everybody knew their neighbors. Upon entering the kitchen, the police found their flashlights insufficient and turned to one of Eddie's kerosene lamps for greater illumination. It's then that one man finds a bowl on the table, specifically something that looks like it was intended to be a soup bowl, except it appears to be constructed of bone. That's when he realizes this is a skull that somebody modified into a bowl by sawing off the top of it like a lid. And it turns out that's not the only soup bowl. The idea here is that Eddie's emotional problems have been consuming him, and because of his mother's abuse, so he gets the skull of a woman like her and consumes everything inside it to symbolically take revenge. His emotional issue is simply mirrored in physicality for lack of an emotional solution. He's telling the story of how he came to be this person. His mother was consuming everything inside of his head, and so, to project that story in physicality, it must be mirrored or reversed to show him consuming everything physically inside of her head. But in this moment, undoubtedly all the man finding this bowl is thinking is that this maniac, Ed Gein, was literally eating out of a dead woman's skull. Investigators then found a pair of fully intact skulls on Eddie's bedposts, hanging there like decorations. A chair in the kitchen had been modified to remove the existing seat and replace it with strips of dried and treated human skin. There were three others nearby just like it. They found a belt decorated with female nipples and lampshades constructed of human skin. There was even a drawstring for one of those shades that was anchored by a woman's lips. There was an enormous amount of junk because Eddie never threw anything away, but ironically, he still had a wastebasket on hand that had been woven with human skin. He made, quote-unquote, jewelry with human body parts as well, such as bracelets. Now, like I said previously, there's no electricity here, but by this time they're able to get a generator to the scene, along with some flood lamps. And once they illuminate these horrors inside Ed Gein's home, the symbolic renderings of what was inside his head come to bear in totality. There are some photos online that were taken by the media at the crime scene, but they simply don't do justice to the totality of filth, clutter, and horrifying decorations because they were taken after law enforcement processed the scene and opened it to reporters. By then, everything from Bernice Warden's carcass to the death masks had been collected as evidence. In the dense shadows and darkness of the room, when it was only lit by flashlights and a kerosene lamp, there was a strong sense that they weren't even close to uncovering the full extent of Eddie Gein's atrocities. That's when a man from the crime lab discovered a shoebox. Inside, he finds a small collection of shriveled skins, 8 of them, while another, which is actually quite fresh, rests on top of the dried ones. The man suddenly realizes the shriveled skins look like the opening to a vagina, and upon examining the fresh skin more closely, it dawns on him that these dried skins are each a vulva that was removed from a woman. The fresh one, however, actually has the vagina and anus still attached. Not only that, but it has been painted silver, tied closed with a red bow, and sprinkled with salt. Wow. So, allow me to explain the decorative aspects of this. What Eddie really wants, due to his mother's abuse, is to be a woman. If you recall, she never loved him, nor did she show him any affection, and was quite cruel to him because he turned out to be a boy instead of a girl. Eddie always knew that, and so the more his mother withheld her love, and the more he wanted it, but couldn't get it because he was a boy, and later a man, the more desperately he wanted to become a woman to cope. This new, or fresh, vagina with the bow on top is a gift to himself to symbolically make his mother happy by way of his transformation to being a woman. Of course, the irony is that Eddie's mom, Augusta, though she desperately wanted Eddie to be a woman, raised him to find every other woman besides her unacceptable. The only way to keep her sons away from the sexual influence of their peers was to vilify all other women and girls. So ultimately, Eddie has no choice but to become a woman who is his mother. He can't become his own woman because mother wouldn't approve. In that light, since Eddie is giving himself a brand new vagina, and it's a gift, he uses the bow as both a way to celebrate receiving the gift to himself, and also uses it to close off the vagina entrance by tying it so that his desires of being a woman and his mother's desires of never having to engage in sex with men can be accommodated symbolically. He's saying, "Look, Mom, you can love me now. I have this gift of a vagina, and I'm a girl. But don't worry, because I promise not to use the thing." And so we go on to learn that Eddie had already used that severed female genitalia to place over his own penis. Now for the crazy part. Why in the world did he paint it silver? And why is the bow red? Well, on the color scale, as I talk about, our evolution starts in complete darkness and then goes across the scale to the white light. Therefore, just like we say in society when something isn't logically black and white, so to speak, the middle of the color scale is specifically a gray area. If you were looking at the actual colors on the scale, green would be the center, but if you examine the center in the context of merging the bookends of total darkness with the totality of white light at the other end, In the middle, you would get gray. And the middle of the color scale, just as you would find when weighing something on a scale, precipitates balance. Gray is perfectly situated between light and darkness. That's the appeal. But why silver and not gray then? I mean, we get the neutrality part. Ed wants peace in a war going on inside his head between the darkness and the light. Gray would be the place in the middle that manifests that idea of peace. Now, if we consider the practical aspects of this choice, we would understand that the colors of silver and gray, for the same reasons I just mentioned regarding neutrality and balance, are very popular in society. In fact, white, black, gray, and silver, for that specific reason, comprise the colors of 78.5% of all cars driving on the road in the United States today. This happens because cars or vehicles are consistent with the idea of forward movement or evolution, and we, as humans, only act in favor of bringing emotional balance or peace to that chaos, so the choice of a neutral colored vehicle manifests the idea of bringing balance through movement. But again, how do we differentiate silver from gray? That's the key here to understanding it. Well, we start with the red bow. A two-sided bow, tied on a gift, mimics the shape of the infinite loop to the best of practicality. And so, in our evolution, we're given the task of turning the circle into the straight line and extracting the circle so that only the straight line exists in the end. Therefore, the person giving the gift takes a straight line and turns it into a bow or infinite loop, while the person receiving the gift then reverse engineers that process and extracts those circles on the bow by turning them back into the straight line, allowing universal truth or the identity of what's inside the box to enter the light by crossing through darkness. Just like the idea of something being 100% or the totality of everything, the straight line, or one, adds two zeros with the two-sided bow and then goes back to being the one, or God, when you extract those two bows by pulling them forward until they become a straight line again. Those two bows, or circles, or zeros, are the mother and son characters in our evolution, just like Mary and Jesus. In order for Jesus to become God, however, or the straight line, he must extract Mary and Jesus, the zeros. So watch this. When Eddie Gein went into Bernice Worden's store that fateful morning of November 16, 1957, how much did his half gallon of antifreeze cost? 99 cents. Eddie gave Bernice $1, or 1.00. She removes the two zeros, or circles, leaving only the one remaining, which equates to what in our evolutionary narrative? Change, or transcendence, to becoming the Father. So, to symbolize Eddie receiving change for his efforts, Bernice goes into the cash register and receives Eddie's physical change in the form of a penny. Now, look at the tragic irony caused here by manifesting this idea only in physicality and absent of any type of emotional change. When Bernice gives Eddie his change, meaning makes him the one by giving him a penny back, or 1 cent, how is that penny shaped? It's still a circle. Clearly, you can see why Eddie went on to steal the entire cash register in the aftermath. He didn't get the change he wanted, so he had to take it all. Now, if you want balance or peace, but will only seek it in physicality, and not by changing emotionally through different choices leading to different actions based in sacrifice, but instead sacrificing others, as Eddie does here, then you just remain in the red giant. it keeps growing and growing, and the universe tells you when you see the pool of blood growing around the victim. Now, where does the red giant happen? What is the location we talk about on an emotional level? The mirror universe, right? The abyss. Now, why do we call it the mirror universe? Because our physical reality is simply a projection or reflection of our emotional world. Therefore, what we learn is the difference between gray and silver is simply that silver is a reflective version of gray. The red giant happens down in the mirror universe, meaning it rises up from our emotional world to be projected upon a physical canvas, and so here, Eddie chooses the reflective version of the color scale center as silver rather than gray. If you were to structurally qualify the place on the color scale where nothing ever changes, it would be precisely in this location. And of course, we know that's what Ed Gein wants more than anything. So, in line with that notion, and also adding to the earlier discussion about extreme conservatism ultimately becoming the desperation to preserve that which is already dead, Ed Gein has sprinkled salt all over this item. Yet in the moment, as the crime lab tech realizes he's literally holding Bernice Worden's vagina and anus, he obviously has one big question. Why? What is Ed Gein doing with these things? What is the gift to himself? Here's where the logic gets as funny as it does crazy. In another nearby box, this man discovers a handful of noses. They don't seem to have a purpose like the vulvas. They're not fashioned into anything that could be used. So what does this mean? Well, if your house was full of body parts from dead people you murdered and graves you robbed, you'd be completely paranoid. In that light, and given how sloppy this operation is, along with its likelihood for being discovered eventually, what is the one thing you would keep telling yourself in an act of denial to cope with the paranoia of their prying eyes? You would tell yourself, nobody knows. And so Eddie cuts off their noses, manifesting the idea that nobody knows because he's doing this to people who don't have a nose anymore. Of course, all of these early discoveries of women's body parts are happening inside shoeboxes because Eddie is clearly saying, I want to walk in these shoes. And that reality hits home when they next find a pair of human leggings, meaning actual human skin used like stockings pulled up over the legs. But if that doesn't paint a clear portrait of what's going on here, what they unearth next will surely leave no doubt as to this man's desires. Eddie had created what is described as a mammary vest from one of his victims. He removed the entirety of her skin from the upper torso, front and back, including the breasts, and tanned it, at which point he used cord to lace it up into a garment. Of course, that's so disturbing that anybody in their right mind has to stop and ask what Eddie believes he's accomplishing by doing all of this. And the answer isn't going to be rational or logical, rather, it's structural. As I've said, our evolutionary process involves combining the straight line and the circle. So in this house, Eddie will manifest a story in symbolic images to say why he did it. Now, you and I already know why. The path to cleansing ourselves of sin is to emotionally purge the ego, which resides inside our heads. So, what evolution specifically does in its process is purge everything emotional related to ego or embodiment from our heads over time. Yet, we know Eddie is incapable of such. He's going back the other way, like the Antichrist, remember? That means all we have to do to see the manifestation of Eddie purging all the bad things inside his head is to look for the straight line being extracted from the circle instead of combining with it. And here we go. There's a big container in the kitchen, a product most of us can recognize very easily. And what is it called? Quaker Oats. The Q, meaning a straight line breaking a circle, gives way to the O, which extracts the straight line in favor of keeping the O or circle unbroken. They never combine. That's what Eddie's mother wanted, for him to never use his straight line or erection to enter or break the circle or womb of a woman. That's the poison inside his head that his mother believed needed to be cleansed. He wasn't able to do that emotionally. He still desired women and had thoughts of sex. So when they take the lid off the container, obviously, it's full of brain matter. He cleaned out the inside of someone's head, or many people's heads, and put the brain matter inside here. Instead of sacrificing himself emotionally, he sacrifices someone else physically, and that leaves us with someone else's brain matter instead of his emotions being the thing purged from the head. And of course, when we think of whose brain matter this is symbolically supposed to be, all of these women represent mother. Now at this point, the people searching the home are like, okay, we found the shoeboxes leading to the leggings, leading to the mammary vest, leading to the contents of the head, and even the skulls lying around. But in all of this mess, where the hell are the rest of the victims' faces? Mary Hogan's face, of course, is found in a bag behind the kitchen door. Scattered elsewhere in the rooms Eddie used were multiple other faces, some of which had been oiled for preservation and were still identifiable. Now, while these horrors were so grotesque that the people searching the home couldn't quite comprehend the madness at hand, there was also a great deal of apprehension and anxiety at play because this virtual graveyard Eddie had in his home was located entirely within a few rooms on the first floor. There were still other rooms on the first floor, and even five of them on the second. Yet strangely enough, the police learned the rest of the house was unused. Well, sort of. Downstairs, one of the bedrooms and the parlor had been sealed off, specifically nailed shut, seemingly years earlier, and this was the part of the house where Mom's bedroom was located, along with the living room where she kept her best furnishings. Mother had a lot of pride for her neat, spotless home, and Eddie wanted to accommodate that desire, even in death, so he boarded this section off. When law enforcement entered, having ripped out the nails, they said everything was in perfect order. Not one thing was out of place, but the entire room was layered in dust. It was clear to them that nobody, not even Eddie, had been inside there in years. Now, in our evolutionary narrative, like I've said, the heart represents the body, or Jesus, and the mind, or head, is God. What's supposed to happen is that the heart, which facilitates embodiment, or ego, gives way to the mind in the red giant of change, meaning that the red giant must implode upon itself. We shed the ego in the red giant. So here, to symbolize the fact that Eddie wanted to do that but didn't have the emotional capacity to accommodate, the police find Bernice Warden's heart in a plastic bag lying at the front of Eddie's pot-bellied stove. What he is saying is that he couldn't do it, even though he wanted to. And so the heart is at the stove, meaning physically, but it's apparent Eddie didn't have the emotional fortitude or heart to suffer the red giant. And therefore, we see that it has not been placed into the fire and has not imploded, but is remaining. Now, back on the subject of being a man on the outside, or physically, but a woman on the inside, or emotionally, law enforcement discovers a folded men's suit in the home. Obviously, there is no man inside it, but when they peel back the top layer, they suddenly find all the guts Eddie removed from Bernice Warden's glistening torso, and they're packaged in newspaper. What Eddie is doing, just like the newspaper, is telling them a story. One about how, yes, he was a man on the outside, but on the inside, emotionally, he was a woman. This would be news to them, so it's inside the newspaper. The police learned that Eddie had stuck a nail in each of Bernice Warden's ears and tied cord between so that he could hang her head on the wall like art. I think what's missing from that analysis is that the head having been disembodied is symbolic of the deification process of becoming God, or ascension, and so Eddie is going to elevate and hang the disembodied head to symbolically, but falsely, suggest that he has become the Father. The universe, of course, is designed to mock the effort, and so, as Eddie proudly displays this ascended head as being indicative of becoming the Father, we clearly understand that the face shows us it's actually a woman. In truth, he became the mother, not the father, so the universe just tells us. Soon enough, law enforcement told the media, which was called the press at that time, of course, that there were no fewer than 10 dead bodies inside the home, or parts of 10 corpses, and could be as many as 50. Investigators, along with the press and the public, were baffled as to how Eddie Gein could have committed so many murders like this over the years without getting caught. It was just too many. Something was wrong. Even a cursory look at the situation would reveal that Eddie had seemingly abducted and killed more women of a certain age and look than had actually been reported missing. It was like he murdered unknown people. They weren't missed. But for a man who never left the area, how the hell could he find that many women who weren't missed by their loved ones? There had to be a rational explanation for this, something that brought sense to the matter. So they have Eddie at the police station now, and he's being interviewed. They haven't charged him with murder yet, as they're trying to assess the totality of the situation, but he's being held on a larceny charge related to stealing the cash register. And if that didn't sum it up, nothing else would. Eddie Gein tried to steal the change he desired for himself, and it failed. By then, investigators realized the change he sought, from the shoeboxes to the leggings to the vest to the faces, was to become a woman. But not just any woman. The only one that ever mattered, or ever would. Mother. When they question him about the murders, Eddie speaks softly and with a total lack of awareness regarding the severity of his atrocities, as though he was simply making small talk when discussing how he butchered Bernice Warden like an animal and made a wall decoration out of her head. He was small, timid, and childlike, and at every turn left people, from these cops to the general public and the press, wondering how someone like this could be driven to such remarkably heinous crimes. He didn't seem capable to them. And that's when Eddie told them about his spells. When Eddie got urges, the ones so bad he was led to act, he prayed for mercy, and sometimes it came. Sometimes he could stop himself. But on other occasions, as had happened with Mary Hogan and Bernice Warden, Eddie couldn't stop himself, and those times, he said, are when he would suddenly find himself descending into what he described as a daze. Once he was entrenched in one of these dazes, he would black out and remember almost nothing about what he had done in the immediate aftermath. What's normally apparent, however, is that before the blackout, Eddie acts as himself, and yet once it's underway, somebody else takes over, somebody easily understood as being Mother because the results mirror her desires. So when Eddie is faced with something he must do physically because Mother is dead but doesn't want to do it, he must find a way to be the body for her will. That means he utilizes his body in these acts, yet surrenders his mind or consciousness to Mother's will until the deed is done, when he comes to realize what's happened, just like Norman Bates. I don't think Eddie actually suffered these dazes. I believe it was the very long and difficult way around saying that Mother's influence made him do it. But there was still the issue of quantity at that time in the interrogation. How many people did Eddie kill? And who were they? Investigators grilled him about all the local legends, the really mysterious ones that had never been solved. But aside from Bernice and Mary Hogan, Eddie didn't seem to fit the profile. It was apparent to the investigators that most, if not all, of the victims fell in the age range of Mary Hogan and Bernice Warden, and outnumbered the total possible unsolved murders of that type of person in that region of the state. Furthermore, they noticed that some of the body parts they recover smell like formaldehyde, and they wonder if Eddie had applied it. Otherwise, the only rational explanation for a corpse or its parts to emanate an odor like that would be that the items in question had been involved in an embalming process. The truth is starting to dawn on them. So they ask Eddie, aside from the identifiable Bernice Warden and Mary Hogan, whose carcass and death mask respectively were easily recognized, how did Eddie manage to acquire so many middle-aged women who were never reported missing or murdered? He told them, quite simply, the obituaries. Eddie would peruse the local obituaries in the region for recently deceased women who reminded him of his mother. He made countless trips to the graveyards, he said, but on perhaps only 10 occasions, give or take, did he actually dig somebody up and rob the grave. Most of the time he talked himself out of it and would go home. Like the murders, these robberies also happened in a daze, indicating that Mother's will was at the controls, something that makes perfect sense, given she's the one who needs a body in the aftermath of her death. So this is Mother embodying herself, rising from the abyss unchanged, allowing Eddie to still be the son or boy, but in a manifested physical way, absent emotional evolution. That means, instead of Eddie rising like Christ, the son, cleansed of embodiment, to become the father, he instead, as the Antichrist, rises covered in dirt, remaining the boy in a man's body, or man-child, having not evolved, and restoring embodiment, the polar opposite of what is intended in evolution. He just mirrors it. And of course, the universe, giving us symbolic images of Eddie holding on to the embodiment of the mother, even after death, tells the story of his wound. While Eddie Gein only confessed to robbing 9 graves, it's widely believed that he could have robbed dozens. The truck used to haul away evidence from Eddie's home reportedly made about 30 trips, and you have to consider that Eddie only inhabited a few rooms in the house. Given the enormity of the findings, the true accounting of his grave robberies might never be known. He obviously had an inclination for seeking fresh bodies, and therefore looked for freshly dead people who would have freshly dug graves that would have their dirt disturbed already. As dirt on top of graves is generally left to settle, it appears to be loose. So he was hiding his work in plain sight. Authorities were not about to dig up every dead woman in the region just to see if Ed Gein had robbed their graves. We generally let the dead rest in peace if we can, so the number could be much higher. Soon enough, Ed starts admitting to things that would later make him the inspiration for Buffalo Bill. He tells the detectives that he used to dress up in the human leggings and wearing the mammary vest along with one of his masks, and he would complete this wholly grotesque and corrupted transformation of becoming a woman by then placing one of the vulvas over his penis, disguising it, at which point he sometimes danced in the moonlight. That was what made Bernice Worden's vagina and anus combo so appealing. It's why he decorated it like a gift to himself. It was fresh, even still warm, almost like it came from a living person, and so when he placed that thing over his penis, there was no denying it was real. He saw a transformation. And on these occasions, he often proceeded to wear women's underwear to secure the severed flesh in place, which led to another obvious conclusion as well. Eddie was dressing the rest of his parts like a woman, too. I mean, guess whose clothes he still had after she died? Mother. And that is exactly how we get Norman Bates committing murder, dressed as Mother. It is her will behind his face, and so obviously Leatherface comes from the idea of Eddie Gein reversing that notion so that he physically can be behind the face of his mother. He is going to be her will when he dresses up like that, because she's doing it to him. Now, if you recall what I said about the silver paint on the freshly cut vulva earlier, and how that silver was indicative of the middle of the color scale, just watch how the structure applies perfectly when Eddie provides his reasoning for doing that. Those vulvas, of course, are flesh and will decompose quickly, especially when cut away from the rest of the body. So the problem Eddie ends up having with them, again, by way of structural necessity, needs to be something related to the center of the color scale. In that light, Eddie says the problem, the reason that he painted this thing silver, was that the decomposing vulvas were all turning green. Green, of course, is the center of the color scale. Here's the difference. Black and white aren't colors, but the absence of color and combination of all colors, respectively. When the universe opens, the color scale is created. So even 1 nanosecond prior to that, in darkness, defined as the absence of light, there are no colors, and then, upon what we today still call the Big Bang, and the subsequent several hundred thousand years, we get light and colors, meaning that in life, as you view it, the traditional Roy G. Biv color scale with green at the center is the middle. But in an evolutionary context, defined as the beginning and end, which are both God and the infinite loop, black and white bookend the color scale. First, there is no light at the very start, and at the end, there is only the white light, so we go from no colors to creation of the color scale to white light. That means, in an evolutionary context of the movement from total darkness to the white light, the middle of the color scale is gray instead. That's what you get with the merger of black and white, of course. And if the place you want that color to represent is the abyss, or place of change, where transformation takes place, like becoming a woman, you paint the body parts silver, because again, silver is the reflective version of gray, and the abyss is the mirror universe. That reflection is the manifestation of your emotional world being mirrored back at you in symbolic images. The universe tells you this in many ways. If you were to go to a lake right now and stare at the surface, you'd see yourself reflected back at you. If you look into a mirror, the images are reflected back at you. The point is to say that your emotional world or mind tells stories with symbolic imagery that can then be understood by you after viewing it. So, when somebody like Ed Gein precipitates such events, he does the same. All of these horrors are the ones growing inside his tortured head. Every item in his house of horrors and every gruesome action he took can be traced back to an identifiable emotional deficiency related to abuse. The one thing that is often neglected in the telling of this tale is that, as horrible as Eddie's childhood seemed to have been under his mother, and even as stifling as it was living with her as an adult, the fact that our only true conduit to this isolated existence is Eddie himself, who would never want to upset Mother, means that Eddie only admitted to what was necessary. By no means do I think Augusta Gein was anything less than terribly cruel about Eddie being a boy. After the first child, Henry, being a boy, she was going to collapse under the weight of another, and when it happened, Eddie suffered her wrath in ways I think we might never truly understand, except by way of what he left behind. He wanted us to know how he hurt inside. Inside his head. Inside that house. And inside the prison his mother built. The invisible one he could never seem to escape. The one with no walls, no barbed wire, and nothing to keep him trapped inside. Except fear. Most of us will never exist in such squalor and violence, but in some way or another, we're attracted to this story because we all live in that place. The one with the blacked out windows and the clutter piled high. The one where we used to be surrounded by others, but suddenly we're alone and stuck. There's no light. There's no love. And most importantly, above and beyond any other consideration, we can never let anyone else inside. We look out from those windows, but in the form of our eyes, and from within them we can see everybody running past, turning in fear at the thing we've become. From those windows, we can't see that the house is falling apart. We don't realize that others know it's haunted, that a madman lurks within. We hope and pray that we'll never be found, that they'll continue to run on by, and we can just remain in there, alone and suffering, but comfortable because we're protected from the onslaught of change by the outside world. Yet as we breathe that sigh of relief when they're gone, and we're alone again, suddenly we feel sad, because we want them to come back and look inside, to see our house of horrors, and understand what we've suffered. We never chase them down. We always just wait by the windows, hoping they'll stop running, until one day we finally give them a reason to come. For Eddie Gein, that moment happened on the night of November 16th, 1957, when he precipitated events that, whether he knew it or not, were designed to employ tragic fate to manifest one very specific change. Eddie Gein didn't have to be this person anymore. He could exchange the prison in his head for one in society. In his case, it was a psychiatric facility. It wasn't ideal, and it wasn't home, but it was over. Ironically, after many long years of being suffocated emotionally by Mother, Eddie Gein finally passed away from lung cancer in July 1984. He was 77. So at the conclusion of this tale, I think what resonates with me is that Ed Gein lived the life that most of us do, though in very different ways. He failed miserably in the pursuit of love, over and over again. But even when he found it, there was something missing, something from the past. Yet no matter how hard he prayed or worked to manipulate this cruel world to try to make it his own and keep the past alive, the truth that was always apparent, but strangely never quite accepted, is that yesterday was already gone.